You're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies, brought to you with the support of the University of Sussex Business School. This is episode 52, where we continue to discuss the revised edition of Rosemary Stewart's book, Managers and Their Jobs, a study of the similarities and differences in the ways managers spend their time. To get the text and for more information, please visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We are continuing to discuss Rosemary Stewart's classic work, Managers and Their Jobs, a study of the similarities and differences in the ways managers spend their time. And I know Tom has an interesting observation about the importance of this work.
Well, I wanted to kind of follow on with the end of the previous part when we started to talk about how do we help managers shift their focus to the long term and recognize that you know their continued focus on short term is not going to achieve as much success. And I suppose that the place to start would seem to be in chapter 9, Making the Best Use of One's Time, page 121, of just starting with the questions that she poses right up there. Are you doing the right job? You may be very busy, but are you busy on the right things? Now, that's a good starting question. How can we perhaps as advisors or consultants help leaders or managers translate the answers to those questions to perhaps some sort of a proper balance or a sense of balance between taking care of the short-term alligators that are constantly there to eat up your time versus thinking more strategically, thinking more long-term, longer time horizons, thinking about the direction that the company or the organization should head?
Well, I have an observation about that because that's something I struggle with all the time. I think it starts with making sure you know what you're supposed to do. And I think that's partly getting expectations from your job. It also means talking to your subordinates about what help they need or what you can do to support them. I always started, if there was a written description of what my job is, and a lot of military jobs are like that, they have very clear written descriptions. I would always start with that because I thought that was nicely grounded. And then some organizations, it's based in performance reviews or job descriptions, you know, those kinds of things. And then one of my mantras that I learned after many years of doing things the wrong way was, am I doing someone's day job, somebody else's day job? And sometimes that can occur because there's a person in the job who doesn't do it very well, or they need developmental assistance, or a person's not in that job. So I would think about those kinds of things as well, about whether I was actually doing somebody else's job. And because a lot of times in organizations, if you do that, that person will just step back and let you do it and either not help you or just go into what you might call coast mode. So I think those are a couple of approaches that have worked for me.
So can I jump on that? Because I think it also allows me to say one of the perhaps my critiques to Rosemary, which is, I think it's important to situate and consider also the former organization when thinking about these things. So we have been talking about in-person reflection and the kind of questions and balance that are important to short-term versus long-term, and the kind of questions that might be asked, the kind of issues that might be raised, and the kind of self-raising awareness that are important to be activated. But I think this is a point in which the former organization and the recognition that we always work interdependent with other people comes into play, because I think a lot of this awareness of long-term and thinking about not just solving the crisis here and now or dealing with my problem here and now comes with the ability to understand the overall organization of the work across departments, to have this awareness of the organization and the existence of specific routines and procedures that push people or at least position them into a certain position and with certain requirements. So I studied aeronautical product development, which is by definition a very long-term issue. It takes 6-7 years to create an aircraft, and an aircraft might be flying for next 30 years. And one thing that I noticed that was very important was that the attention that people had been able to develop throughout decades of the interdependence of their tasks. And of course, they're always struggling to learn that and to become more aware of that. But the fact that there were process improvement in place, mapping activities, all kinds of different kind of, you know, structurations that made people have to consider not only what is the solution now, what is my problem now, but how in 30 years this thing we are creating this year is going to raise specific challenges, and is important to consider that.
Oh, and absolutely. I think I agree with you, and in particular about both the timeliness or the longer term aspect, but also the sort of situatedness question, right? I think because of the nature of what Rosemary was trying to do, even though she acknowledges context, and so she acknowledges that industry matters, for instance, right? She acknowledges that. She does not develop that. It's not a critical part of what she's trying to do. And as a result, you know, your context in which you spend a lot of time doesn't necessarily, it's not translated into this. She tries with the examples to hint at that, but there is a little bit less of that than we would necessarily want. And another thing as well that we could similarly kind of point out is what she doesn't capture is what Davide and myself in our International Journal of Management Reviews paper about the managerial work literature highlighted is the absence of recognition of those broader institutional frames in which managerial work also happens. And what I mean by that is, and we touched on it earlier, certain expectations as to what that managerial role should look like or needs to look like. And this brings us back also to this idea of short versus long-termism, right? If the market, for instance, out there, if you're a CEO, is incentivizing you to be short-termist in your actions as well, that might then cascade down in a really, really powerful way. Similarly, you know, to Raf's point, it matters where you are in the hierarchy, and so far as there might be people above you or your board, for instance, if you're a CEO, who might have certain kinds of explicit, implicit assumptions as to what your managerial work or your work as a leader might need to look like. And those wider institutional expectations and frames, including with regard to managerial work, also matter, right? They also pre-frame to what extent you could, for instance, orient yourself in the long term versus in the short term. So I think another thing that, you know, I think it's really useful that Rosemary gives us that opportunity to start from the individual, to start from their choices. She recognizes constraints, and in her later work, she elaborates on this, but she doesn't necessarily get to this idea as well that, you know, managerial work happens in a wider frame. Our critical management scholar colleagues tell us this, including certain kinds of ideas as to what people expect of us when we're in certain kinds of formal roles. And that's not necessarily, that notion of what good might mean is not necessarily picked up either here. So it's not just contextual, it's also institutional.
I thought that was a great point about this, the idea that the board or others may have these other expectations or additional expectations or assumptions about what the nature of your job is or what you should be working on. I got into trouble several times during my career as a practitioner when, fortunately, it was not usually the people I was working for or in my direct chain of command, as we say, but it was people who were advisors or other people that are senior and I needed to pay attention to, but they would often have these incredibly unrealistic expectations for what I was able to do or what I should be doing. And I would try to explain to them, that's not the nature of my job. I don't have any power. I don't have any influence to do that. And on the occasions when I would bring that up, many times the yelling would just get louder because I think they were frustrated that when I tried to point out, they had an illusion or the something they didn't really understand about the nature of how the organization worked, and they got frustrated with me.
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, again, management is fundamentally relational, and not just management, organizations are fundamentally relational, right? So I think the necessary recognition of that, and then this is, you know, to Rosemary's credit, that again, she talks about relationships, she talks about the importance of understanding people in relation to another, but just not quite with the same way that we would appreciate that today, right? So I think that's a really good example of exactly that. You know, you can have certain kinds of intentions, you can have certain kinds of choice, but you will also face other people's, you know, expectations. And as one of the CEOs I shadowed kind of told me once when I asked her, what's the one thing you would kind of wish that people would know about your job? And she said, I wish they would know that I just don't have a magical wand that I can wave and stuff happens. That's just really...
Well, that's a great one, because I was always, people were always trying to get me to use the magic wand they knew I had to have, you know, that I could just change people or make them do stuff.
Yeah.
That's a great wish.
That's really not the case. Her chuckle was very sort of poignant in this recording, and I cherish it to this day.
So we talked about some of the... limitations of the work of Rosemary, and Maya brought up the issue of lack of context, and both in the organizational level but institutional level. And I was wondering about the perhaps the limitation that we also hinted in the other part about the extent you can go into the nature of the work that's taking place. You know, it's almost like her analysis, because of the nature of the method, are very much on the anatomy of the work, so the syntactic structure, but not really the content, you know, what is being managed, what is being done, what is being decided. And we know that more recent literature has looked at that, and Maya has done research exactly that looks into that. So I was wondering if we could talk about how this the text relates to current research on managerial practice.
Well, in many ways, and this is, I mentioned the IJMR piece that we did, the review piece there. I think, again, we've kind of talked about, and Miranda's mentioned the sort of timeliness, timelessness of this research, in the sense that it's just, it continues to inform. And I think in many ways, the current managerial work literature is interesting insofar as I mentioned already one particular difference. So my approach and Davide's approach has really been in the sort of what we call the practice turn, the practice set of approaches to understanding various organizational phenomena. And that would be much more appreciation of things that are not necessarily in this book, for instance, but are in others, things like materialities as well that make a difference. Things like we talked already about broader institutional expectations that one might have for managerial work. We talked about a little bit of the contextual appreciation, though importantly about Rosemary, this is such a sustained long-term piece of work that career that she's developed. She already looked at international differences, working with German colleagues and others. She looked at the differences between, for instance, public sector and private sector, look at hybridization of those, looking at new public management and how that has changed things. So really appreciating that as well. She acknowledges even in this book that none of the people she studied were men, were women, all were men. And she would have expected some more attention to that. And in fact, she purposely uses she. All of these things are things that certainly in the last kind of couple of years, decades, we've seen a much more sort of attention to. She never got into the bit about what makes it good or bad, the efficiencies. That's a body of literature she's aware of, but it's a body of literature she didn't necessarily go into. And I think this is also perhaps, you know, so she gives generalized, let's say, meaty items for reflection, but she does not give prescription. Not a universalist. And I think this is perhaps also something that, you know, in terms of how her work has been taken up in order to influence the literature, it hasn't necessarily played to her strength, in her favor.
Yeah, I just wanted to pick up on the fact that I really appreciated the opportunity to read this book. And it was a book that I'd never come across. I don't really know why. But I found it super, super fascinating and very timeless. So if someone hadn't pointed out that, look, it's set in the 1960s, I would have easily believed that it was belonging to this year or to a couple of years ago. And that kind of like got me thinking, one, as to why this work isn't a bit more well known, and that's maybe a question that I'll open up to all of our speakers today. But also I found it quite interesting, this idea of talking about time, which is a very very discussed topic nowadays, possibly because we all feel that we lack time. And it's very common amongst a specific group of professionals, especially professionals, even us like researchers. And I found actually quite a lot of important points of reflection for the way that I manage my own time or struggle to manage it, because it's an ongoing battle that I feel I'm constantly losing. So I've looked into things such as bullet journaling and just having some sort of ways of prioritizing and reflecting, which is a bit of a paradox because you're talking about not having time, but you're taking time to do other things to try and create a bit more time. So it's a bit of a serpent that eats itself. But I did want to reflect on or just open up the question as to why this work isn't a bit more mainstream and discussed even within undergraduate and university programs. I'm not sure what the thought is.
Well, I mean, if I could maybe just start there, but I'd be interesting then to hear what others think. I've always kind of struggled with this because when we started doing this work, I was lucky enough also to actually know Rosemary, and she kindly looked at the paper, IJMR paper I mentioned in its early inceptions. I was, like I said, our alma maters were the same. I used to see her around, and Sue Dobson, who she worked with a lot on middle managers, it was also a mentor of mine at Oxford. So I was lucky enough that I, through just where I was, of her work. But what really became quite fascinating, and this is something both David and I talked a lot about, is when you actually dig into the literature itself, it's almost as if she's there and she's recognized by people like John Kosher, like Henry Mintzberg, you know, the kind of the greats of that. But, you know, why is she not there? And just to give you an illustration of that, for instance, earlier today, I sort of went into Google Scholar and I looked at this book and I saw that it's been cited 773 times since 1967. It just in comparison, Mintzberg's The Nature of Managerial Work has been cited 11,611 times. And in fact, his HBR piece in 1975, which is a very short piece, was 2,540 versus 773. So there's not that citations are everything, but she is certainly not as widely cited and this is across a number of her other sources. And she was very prolific. She's written, I think, 7-8 books, if not more. She was prolific across different contexts. She worked in the UK NHS. She worked, like I said, in Germany, looking at a variety of settings as well, public sector. But, you know, so for me, always a big question was why? And I think I've gotten to a couple of key things. And I have like four reasons. That's my four reasons. And I'll go through them very quickly. I think the first one, and this is one that she acknowledges as well in that Leadership Quarterly 2003 piece that I was talking about earlier, is the fact that she has almost entirely consistently throughout spoken about management and not leadership. And at a time where leadership very, very, very much picked up, and we talked about this in IJMR, almost today all we hear about is leadership, and management is sort of the dungeons or the infrastructural plumbing of organizations that nobody really wants to touch, you know, with a barge pole or talk about too much. Not really, but you know, the leadership is the snazzy bit. And she talks about the fact that she could have easily talked about leaders and their jobs if she had chosen, but that wasn't what she was interested in. And in fact, I think Mintzberg also insists on talking about managers precisely because of this glorification of leadership. But maybe, you know, if she had talked about leadership, that would have been different. So that's my sort of number one. It still doesn't explain the difference between her and Mintzberg, which I actually think is the second reason more so, which has to do with this way in which it's presented. And I think this book is a good example of that. It is good and bad, because this is the most quantitative book, right? But she is so thorough. She's writing at a time where scientific presentation of data was a really big thing, because management studies was not recognized really as a proper science yet. And so she's trying in many ways to echo a canon of science that perhaps today, certainly ethnographers like myself, we perhaps wouldn't be in that frame. That would not be the conversation or the aims that we would be seeking with our work. But she tries that. And as a result, the way she represents work is very, 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 there's lots and lots and lots and lots of detail. Very few figures, very few extractions, very few, you know, Mintzberg's 10 roles and, you know, propositions. What is it? Roles and propositions, right? It's very, it's much less sort of user-friendly. And I think that user-friendliness then echoes into really why it's not picked up. You know, and if you look at her publications, you know, she has no HBRs. She's published in Journal of Management Studies, a couple of other smaller, largely European-based journals, and then just worked on books. And in fact, she has, and this touches on another reason, third reason, the way she's seen scholarship has always seemed to me to be much more about developing longer-term bodies of work that are practically relevant and that speak to the context where she can be close to that context and therefore make kind of a meaningful difference. And I think that's really, really, you know, it framed the way she engaged with it, because she ended up not really engaging in the sort of publishing an HBR, going kind of abroad. And as she says, she was running international conferences of leadership. She just didn't necessarily work on this. But the final one I want to just maybe highlight, and perhaps this is slightly contentious, but again, you know, to Miranda's point, this seems timeless, but she was of a certain time. And I think that's important to say. And in that Leadership Quarterly, I found it really interesting. You know, she acknowledges the fact, and by the way, it's called something like On Being a Woman in a Man's World. And in fact, she talks, for instance, in the end about just one excerpt that I want to read. There were prejudices too. I remember asking a prominent management figure whom I knew well to be a referee for an application for a full professorship at another university. And he said no, as, quote, no woman could hold such a job as she be gate-crashing a man's world. I at least had a teaching post in management. When I first had my job at the college, this is at Oxford, I remember visiting the Harvard School of Business in the late 1960s and talking with the dean. He said no woman in the US could get a job like mine. How times have changed. So I think there is something there, right? It was published in 1967. And as she says, you know, even then, she even talks about how even as a management teacher, there was, quote, greater skepticism that a woman could have anything useful to say about management. And this is her writing in 2003. So I think there's something perhaps also there of, you know, if was at a certain time and at a certain place. And I think that's perhaps why today we talk a lot about Mintzberg and others and culture, but far, far less about Rosemary.
So I had another observation I think that matches your, it's probably the item two about abstractions and not the level of detail and maybe less user-friendly. I actually don't see it that way, but I could see why it would be perceived that way. When she doesn't seem to offer lots of trendy lists of 10 items to go do and to take these actions and prescriptions, right? It's kind of simple prescriptions that are the norm and where you get these 11,000, and no offense to Mintzberg intended, but these sort of 11,000 citations, because it wraps it all up in this nice, crisp, go do these 10 things or these 5 things kind of approach. And what I love about her writing, and I'm like Miranda, I never had seen this or hadn't seen it before, but I'm so glad that Maya suggested that we read this, because I love her approach in chapter 9, where it's more about asking questions and analysis and reflection. And I agree with Miranda, it's a bit of a contradiction. You know, you don't have time, but you need to take time for something that's really hard to do, which is reflecting. But still, I think it's important. And so I wonder if that, I couldn't say. I mean, I think Maya had a very, very complete answer there. So I couldn't say for sure. But it does seem that she takes a different approach to her analysis and recommendations and the way she abstracts what, you know, where you should go. So she doesn't say, well, just do, you know, go here. It's you need to look at your own context. So that, I think that's one aspect where the nature of the research is such that it couldn't be very context specific, but then she says, here's how you could do it for your context, which I thought was very good, but maybe contributed to her being less influential, which is unfortunate because it's really good stuff she's writing.
Well, and I'll go back to what I mentioned before, and I'm just guessing here, and just thinking out loud. But this approach is quite different from the mainstream one of HBR, or just think about all the typical case study on how the manager is always the hero that is going to save the situation, or is the one in power to have the decision. It's all about, usually it's a him, not a her, but anyway, it's usually about the manager. And again, she is almost like putting forward, and it reminds me a lot of Mark Parker Follett, which we discussed in the podcast at the beginning, actually, one of the first episodes, which is more relational, reflective, there is no final answer, it depends on the context, and so on and so forth, which is not the one-size-fits-all, that's the hero in town, that mainstream management literature still today is putting forward.
Absolutely. And actually, and conversely, so Pedro will know this, but, you know, just I'll mention, I'm actually a part of Thinkers 50, which is an organization which is kind of has on its list of thinkers, management thinkers, a lot of people who today are considered to be quite, quote unquote gurus, right? Including Henry and others, right? And what's really, really interesting is quite a few people, and I've been to some events, and so on, and looked at their work, and quite a few people, even publishing in places like HBR, the format, the approach is very similar. It's recognizing that context will always be different, that universal prescriptions will not save us, that we have to reflect. And so it's not just, you know, there's a role for the system, but this kind of focus also on the individual and what the individual can do is also such a power, it's such a powerful thing underneath so many HBR pieces, right? What can you as an individual do? And so, again, to Miranda's point, this is such a timeless approach that she's taking, and it's something that we see in some of that work, including the Thinkers 50 sort of guru type of writing today, asking questions, getting you to ask different questions, right? What it has, however, is brevity, nice figures, presentation, and as Raph was saying, checklists, summaries, visually kind of palatable information. And I think this is, I was reading sort of the final chapter, and really in the best way possible, could almost see the way it could be repackaged and reformatted in a way that if we slotted it with a couple of sort of figures, maybe a better sort of tying in together, these are the three factors, these are the five questions, these are the seven actions, this could be published right now. And in fact, maybe we could run it.
That could be an experiment.
Let's do an experiment and get it. But it's so, and it's right there, right? And I think if nothing else, not to in any way, because I think this is such, it has such a consistency of work. And I think deep appreciation, Raph was saying, of as well, of just what the opus is. She started in the early 60s. She was publishing still in the early 2000s, and she died in 2015. She had an incredible life of scholarship and incredibly consistent work as well. And this is something we have to keep in mind.
Yeah, and just as this is a quick note, the line of questioning approach is something that I've been doing in a bit of the work that I'm involved in here at the Army War College, because we're trying to teach our students how to lead and manage change, and we had in the past used a lot of the business literature, the popular business literature, which sort of took the multi-step prescriptive approach. And I'm trying to reshape that into lines of questioning that draw from a much wider range of organizational literature. So instead of trying to say, follow these numbers of steps, let's walk through what are the questions that you want to answer? And then based on that, based on the answers, here are other questions that you want to follow. But so it's more like a decision tree. It's not a set of steps. And the line of questioning doesn't channel or cause the students to shape their change problem in any artificial way. It tries to keep it as open-ended. It's a very difficult way to write in terms of trying to help build tools for people's for people to use. But I think it's been, at least for the setting in which I'm in, far more effective than following a bunch of steps that everybody knows won't work.
Yeah, and I mean, I have to be also reflective here. I mentioned already the MIT Sloan piece. That kind of questioning approach is something we took as well, right? So it's not, I can't say that it was directly influenced by specifically Rosemary, but again, it made sense, right? If you accept that context matters, if you accept that all those features, so the demands will be different, constraints will be different, your choices will be different, your, you know, who you engage and why you engage them will be different. Your capacity to organize your work will be different. That means we just absolutely cannot talk about universal prescriptions. And therefore, what we can only do is to, give reasonable questions that are informed by good scholarship, but then also give some tough love. And I think this is lovely about Rosemary, that she absolutely does. And there's a lot also of common sense in this. And I think that's another nice thing as well.
Well, on that note, I think we've had a wonderful conversation on this really important work. And as Miranda has said, timeless, because it can apply now. It's sometimes hard to believe that she actually wrote this in the 60s. And what a prolific career Rosemary Stewart had. I want to thank our special guest, Maya Korica, for joining us. And as usual, you can find out more information and get links to the things we've been reading on our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Thanks for listening.